Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you in understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. This is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. You know, I get a lot of emails that come in, and no, I don't get back to all of them. I used to. But you fall behind, given the fact you have a lot of other things to do as well. And I have to work with my clients as a priority, and the time goes in interstitial to that, right? But there are a lot of good questions that have yet to be answered. And one person had asked to go over labs. Don't I love going over labs, right? But to go over labs, and they actually are a physician and already have the understanding, and the question was posed, and it's a pretty reasonable question, and I'm trying to pitch it so it's not just kind of advanced level lab discussion. We'll do some of that, because my whole gig, whether it's podcast or the YouTubes I put out there, is to have what you formerly thought was inaccessible information beyond your knowing, somebody you had a trust to interpret for you, and that is your labs. I do a lot of different labs, but I'm trying to bring a degree of common sense into this so you can digest it and use it and sort of see. I think there is a big miss when people go, oh, just eat natural foods and things will work out. I think that is not very helpful. I mean, that's true, but it really doesn't help anybody. It needs to be much more specific than that, because we are not all the same person. We are not robots. We're not like saying, take your car in to get fixed every, you know, maintenance every year, whenever that comes up for you. There's not a uniformity of treatments ever for anybody. Having said that, of course, we have a uniformity of behavior. We need to eat, we need to breathe, we need to sleep, real basic stuff. So between that and you look at somebody's labs, and you wouldn't believe all the times I do labs and people who think, you know, I'm doing quite fine. And I go, well, this actually shows that not so much you're about to pop and have a stroke. Nobody can say something like that, but you're saying your risk factors are pretty, pretty high. And what about this? What about that? And I find it very gratifying to filter and cobble together the most relevant pieces of information and deliver it to somebody who appreciates it, for one, has to apply themselves in understanding it, and I will help them. I'm part of that process, and they can grow on how they need to take care of themselves. And we obviously were all young at one point and didn't need to care about anything, but as we get older, guess what? The responsibility falls to our shoulders to be aware, and we can stop making the excuses that, well, the government says this, or that was okay, or medicine says this. I'm sorry, we are just not in a uniformity of agreement of all these different things to do. And so therefore, I find I can step away from politics or religious orientation and say, can we just do labs? Labs are my truth. Labs and having a piece of what your diet has been for at least a week. So I tell them to track it so I can put these things together. And if it really needs to, push comes to shove, I can look for environmental toxins, which everybody wants to say it's either environmental toxins or it's their genes and there's nothing in their power that they can do to change their lives. I totally disagree with that. Yes, there's a factor of genomic and genetic contribution. And yes, there's an aspect of environmental toxins. Of course, people die of these things. However, for the most part, they are not the first thing I would look at. You work your way down the list to get to that. So what I would like to go over, the question is this, is that what metabolic changes can one expect in the short term and the long term with keto? So going keto, not protein-sparing modified fast, with keto, and that would impact urine testing and then basic blood work, which is liver enzymes, that's basic, lipids, that's basic, renal function, that's basic, albumin and protein levels, that's pretty basic, that's in the kidney function panel anyway. So of those things, so the first thing, you know, I late in my medical practice life realized, you know, the best thing I could have ever done, this is my brother told me that, 20 years ago, said, Carl, just get a spreadsheet of all your lab results, patient after patient. You can make it anonymous or a code so it's not a HIPAA violation. And you'll start seeing things that nobody else is going to see. And he's not even a physician. Our dad was a physician, so we were the sons of a physician. But he was coming from deep research. He was the head of criminal justice for Temple University for about 30 some odd years. And this was how he did. He had to go through the various prison systems and get the data and compare the data so he could have a summary and he could make recommendations. Very similar. Okay, well, I didn't listen to him. Didn't listen to my father much at all either. But in the last 5 years, maybe 10, yeah, 5 years, let's say, that I did start getting a spreadsheet, and which is, as I've said before, it's what the physicians did, family physicians did, or physicians who practice family medicine did in the 50s and 60s. You know, they had to do their own by hand chart, and they would keep a, not everybody, of course, they would keep a spreadsheet so they would know patterns in their environment. They were doing it thinking that, well, I could see if it's a local problem that they're seeing a pattern. But it grew from there. It actually provided great, great insights, and doctors don't do that anymore. You can go to a cardiologist, I was about to say cardiac surgeon, but a cardiologist, a little more general, and ask him about various heart diseases, and what they'll tell you is the studies. No, sir, I'm asking, or ma'am, I'm asking about your firsthand experience because it says on the door you're a cardiologist, which means not only you went to school, but you've been treating people with heart issues for like 10, 20, 30, 50 years. What's your experience? Don't give me the studies. And that part's been missing. Whether they're afraid of the liability and they're just keeping their heads down till they can retire and just walk away from it all, I have no idea. But it's not being done, is the point, right? Okay, so let's get the lab work. I pop up my spreadsheet. I mean, I pretty much know it by now. That's the other thing. By when you go through the tedium, when you go through the tedium of having to get the labs and put it into a spreadsheet, and boy, don't I hate the way lab companies give you the data. There should be a logic to it, and now it's just a jumble of soup, and it takes a lot longer to get this information. But once you get it there, the nice thing about these spreadsheets, regardless of what your computer system is, you can sort, for one. Hey, that was an idea. You can sort by all the variables you put in, of course, but that would be, in the very least, gender, age, condition, if you want to do that. You could do by weight, height and weight, certainly. You could do by, if you want to do geography, I really don't do by that. But then you can start getting into what are the cross-references for. Pick a test. Cholesterol. And we've done this in some of the videos, and you see how, per your own experience, without meaning to be controversial, you realize the whole idea of elevated cholesterol is complete and utter bullshit. Complete and utter bullshit. Yeah, there is a thing called familial hypercholesterolemia, and that's a special genetic predisposition that causes them to have high cholesterol. And it is high. You do a blood draw on them, it doesn't come out red, it comes out pink. The word is lipemic. And anyway, so backing out that exception, you'll find, because you now have your own experience. You now have your own data that goes from 50 to 100 to 200. It's like, that's it. Maybe you want to publish it or not, that's a whole nother thing. But I'm saying you have your experience. It's like an auto mechanic that has worked on his 1,000 cars. He knows that car, that model car. He's been in it, around it, and through it 100 times, 1,000 times. And that's the point. If you don't do that, you don't see, I'm speaking of anybody who collects and works with labs in general, if you don't do that, it's always, you know, tell me what to expect. Well, you will see the story unfold and you will feel very comfortable in the opinions that you have that may be controversial in some aspects, but you can say, you know, sorry, 50, 100, 200,000 patients that you have seen, you can quickly scan their labs and you can see how there's various basic correlations. We're talking basic correlations, not esoteric. You're always going to have some outliers in various labs, and that will provoke you to go, why is this here? What, you know? And then if you're like me, you will go to a genomic panel, or you will go to an intracellular nutrient level panel, or you'll go back and you'll look at their dietary, you know, documentation on whatever app they're using now. Before, they used to have to do it longhand. And you will then say, I see what's going on. You really have the tools to help this person in front of you, not check in and check out. It's just amazing. That's all I can say. So contrary to the advice, well-intended and experienced advice, I either didn't do it because I didn't have time. When you run your own practice, you're running around and you can't even catch up with yourself, let alone anything else. So let's go over the basic labs, and I will go, I'm just calling it up right now. And so, by the way, I don't do much in the way of urine tests anymore. They're pretty much part and parcel with basic labs. And now that I kind of work with clients and I charge them for all the labs and so on and so forth, it's not a covered thing. So I try to pare down the unnecessary costs, but certainly had plenty of labs prior to that I can speak to. And so let's say somebody's starting keto. So first of all, I have to say that nobody starts in the same place. So when I am looking at a person, I'll just take a swath of people that I'm looking at, and I'll say, all right, let's look at a swath of people, male and female, between 25 and 65, and we'll say, what will we start with? We will start with insulin levels, right? There you go. Most doctors don't take insulin levels. Oh, there you go. That's not even an esoteric test. That's a cheap test. That's a $5 test, $10 maximum. And you should do it in tandem with your glucose fasting, of course. So what would that tell you? If you're talking to a person who's going to start keto and they're starting fasting, we're not even talking about a Krebs test. We're not talking about a glucose tolerance test. We're talking about one fasting glucose and insulin. If they're starting at numbers, let me tell you this, brace yourself. Where's the top end number that I have? It is the highest insulin that I've had. Here we go. Highest insulin. This is insulin. Highest insulin I've had, somebody who's starting keto, is 52. And the highest glucose was 201. Now, let me tell you what normal, quote unquote, normal should be. Normal should be, ideally, I go, you know, two or less is ideal. Five and under, I'm not going to worry about it. But when you look at the actual ranges, when you go, whether it's Quest or LabCorp, the ranges go 2 to 20. That's almost a dishonest conveyance of information. And the reason it goes such a huge, broad range is because we have become fatter, obese, metabolically ill, and all the other things that come with that. And so the average of the people that come in are drifting up to being more and more pathologic. They're not healthy numbers, but because so many people have non-healthy numbers, well, that's the average. So let's forget about the average and say, what is healthy? Healthy, again, is certainly under 5. I look for under 2. Nobody's going to get scolded if they're under 5 and not under 2, by the way. So that's just my showing people what I consider the ideal number to have. So glucose, you know, ideally is like 85. Some people are on average, without being a special individual, as low as mid-70s. And people like me run up into the 90s. And so the average is about 85, to keep it rounded off. I think it's like 86 and a quarter or something, but we'll call it 85. All right, so this guy who's starting, and it is a guy, he's obviously diabetic. And so he's going on to keto. What would we expect for him? Well, him, you'd have to be really careful. You'd have to be really careful because what else does he have? You can bet his triglycerides are high. That means he's a carb eater, which is primarily what carb and sugar and sweets and so on, is 408. What about his HDL? Well, it's almost non-existent, down in the 30s and so on. Now you get a picture of that. So if we're starting with that person has to be watched. And here's what I would expect that would happen. You counsel them on what a ketogenic diet is. And so we're going back in history and saying, William Wilder, 2021, coined, hey, I wish there was a ketogenic diet instead of fasting to help people. That's exactly how it came. That's more or less the whole extent of that conversation. And 5 years later, they cobbled together what they considered a safe ketogenic diet with Dr. William Pennington from both of the Mayo Clinic, which is really just a small local hospital at the time in Rochester, Minnesota. And it came down to this. They were worried they needed to have, it was about epilepsy primarily, of course, but it was 20 grams of carb, total carbs. So, and by the way, forget about, don't get sucked into the net carbs. Just tell them to blow a whistle. You know, it's just irrelevant. It's a marking scam. Tell them to go away. So it's total carbs. Keep it simple and keep it real and keep it accurate. Total carbs. So you have total 20 grams of total carbs. Where do you think they're going to come from? Well, they ideally should come from green leafy vegetables. I'm not going to go into much the how, but this is where you would go. We're talking about keto. We're talking about, that's a classic ketogenic diet. And then you have, you're looking at what they calculated was, back then was a gram. Well, they had 1 gram per kilogram of ideal body weight. They did body weight. What they meant was, what was the appropriate height and weight, and geared off in that, because otherwise you're going to be, you know, somebody's 500 pounds, you're going to give them way too many carbs and so on and so forth. So, and their former versions, what we now consider today an ideal body weight based on height and weight primarily, and then a little bit secondarily gender, slight difference between the genders. Okay, now you've got the protein out of the way, which is actually low protein, but they were worried about how much protein should someone have, and they were worried that the protein would convert to glucose through gluconeogenesis and then bring up the blood sugar level and then be a spark for an epileptic fit, seizure. So they were very careful. So they saw carbs and proteins as two potential fires, and they wanted to keep that fire. And so they smothered the fire with fat. Fat was non-glycemic, it was non-insulinogenic, it didn't trigger either, and so that's where they began. So why I say that now, when people say, hey, going keto, what do we expect to see when going keto? Well, that's the classic ketogenic diet. And then from there, you can move up and you can, well, some people like Virta Health, for instance, goes up to 50 and they go, oh, 50 is fine. And others can go up in higher. So you really need to sort of peg that in. Are we talking about the classic ketogenic diet? That's what I talk about. I'm not into half measures. We're going to do keto. Okay. So in that person, so he's the most extreme person I'm having to deal with. Let's compare him to a good normal person. And that would be, one of these people he has 2.7 for insulin. He has, his glucose is 84. There you go. He's the perfect guy. It happened to be a guy here too. And his triglycerides are 54. They could be, I talk about nice. And his HDL is 87. Okay, so we'll just leave that as the starting place. I can go on and sort of see what his cholesterol is like if you want to, you know, but that's the part we're looking at. He's a pretty safe place to begin. He already has a good metabolic buffer there. So we're at two extremes, and if they're both doing the same diet, I would have different expectations. You know, one, if I'm paid to do this, they would have my number because I need to make sure for the first month the person who is a high insulin and high glucose, you know, the full-fledged diabetic, really needs to work with me over time and not go away and come back. You really need to hold his hand, certainly through the first week, if not through the first month, and have some sort of agreement there. But here's the issue. We're getting into the labs. You really do have to worry about ketones. They're going to be so excited to make their first ketone. They're going to go out and buy the urine strips and saying, hey, it turned purple. I'm making ketones. And so pop that sucker, pop that bubble and say, yeah, that's going to change. And that first couple weeks is the problem week, especially for him, because his ketones will go up. But the problem is, as you're making ketones, they start to be excreted. They're not, you're almost like training your kidney to, no, keep the ketones. Don't have them go out in the urine. So that means the urine test is going to be high ketones, not just a little ketone, high ketones. And the blood will be marginally growing higher ketones, but the kidney is now saying, ketones are good, even though they're spilling them, right? And uric acid is the issue, is you are now going to be having a uric acid rise. And anybody who knows about uric acid, they go, oh, the potential for gout. And there is a thing called pseudogout, which isn't directly measured by uric acid, but it certainly is made worse by elevated uric acid. So I would put uric acid up there, and you look at your BUN, blood urea nitrogen, and you look at your globulin, you look at your creatinine, which is basically, for those not familiar with that, looking at kidney function. Watch that sucker. That's your first, like, all right, let's go through. I need to know how this is going, how you're feeling. And so you would give him a ketometer, and you'd give him a glucometer. If he's diabetic, he already has his glucometer. And so you would watch that. So he obviously has a long way to come down. He can't drop down too quickly if he's used to a 204 for glucose. That was a fasting glucose. His non-fasting is going to be 3 to 4. And he's going to be doing his insulin shots and so on. So that's a whole nother level of look where this person started. And I would definitely be watching about uric acid rise, and then at the end of a month, it will then fall back. You've trained your kidney to sort of say, okay, we keep the ketones and we spill the uric acid. So then the fear of gout will dissipate. And if any patient that has a history of gout, so they have that issue anyway, I would tell them for the first month to stay on their gout medicines, whether it's colchicine or whether they're taking an indomethacin kind of as an anti-inflammatory, even though it's an NSAID, different categories of medicines. I would say, you know, let's believe that the worst is going to happen for these people and make sure that they're, because all I need is one gout attack and they're not going to do it. They're done, not doing keto. It hurts too much, and gout does hurt a lot. Just ask Ben Franklin. Okay, so I would be looking at kidneys. Kidneys are your top of the list, and you can say, well, what about liver? Liver certainly, it's not so much a concern, because if you're dealing with a diabetic, you know, the diabetic I just told you about, you already have his liver panel in front of you, and it's more than likely not very pretty. So let me see if I can spin to that. It is, where'd he go? All right, going down. His liver enzymes actually aren't so bad. There was actually none out of range, but he would be, he has one of the highest dehydrogenase numbers, which is still within range, but barely. And I would look for, you know, the AST, ALT, Elk-Fos, these are all normal. He's on other medications as well, as you can imagine, that's basically managing this. And so for that kind of patient, you know, I won't say it's a house of cards that it's going to fall apart. It's a house of cards in the sense that his life is held together by at least three different medications. And he has been a diabetic for so long and probably has a family history of diabetes, and you look how the family eats and so on and so forth, all those, family social dynamics. And there's going to be a lot of training investing. But in terms of labs, it would be the kidney, then the liver panel. And I don't have one that's going to pop off before the other. We have had some really lactate dehydrogenase is one of the ones that I do look for and don't get a positive very often. But once somebody's high on that, you know, you have to consult them and say, hey, we really have to take this easy and you and I have to work rather closely to go forward on this. And then I would retest. If anybody who's high in LD and moderately high in any of the other liver enzymes, as you probably already know, if you're familiar with all this already, is that you take care and you make sure that they are following along slowly. And they may not be a diabetic, by the way. I've had people with elevated liver enzymes, and now I'm scrolling up to their insulin and glucose. So they're, they had pretty high. No, their insulin was pretty high, 26, 27. And glucose is 113. So they may not have the awareness that, like the 113, they say, oh, that's been my highest glucose. They may not have the awareness, have had the insulin taking away their glucose, and suddenly you go, whoa, buddy, your pancreas is really being pummeled here. You're making it work really hard. And so you have to go through that explanation. So I would definitely, so the tandem insulin, glucose, absolutely necessary. If you want to do a glucagon with that, I found some interesting stories. I'm not quite sure if I consider that necessary. I did it for a while, and then I didn't do it. And then once you don't do it, you find the perfect patient come in that came in. And what you'll find, by the way, with as things progress to degrees of diabetes, that their glucagon becomes less efficient. Right? So you go, well, the glucagon is high. And their insulin's high, they're not supposed to be working that way. Well, what happens is the beta cells then start affecting the alpha cells, and you get some people consider it a burnout. But anyway, you realize there's a degree of pathology that you have to roll back, and you will have to roll back, and that's going to be a long time. So somebody that had that diabetic numbers, you're looking at no quick wins other than they're going to get their ketones up, and you have to make sure you're watching those, both in urine and in blood, for those different changes, right? Uric acid goes up, then it comes down. The ketones go up a little bit, but mostly they spill in the urine, and then they start going up. All right, so let's pretend we're 6 months into it with that guy, or the perfect guy, we'll call him. Well, then you're going to see the level of ketones in blood, and you could do it by, if you want to do ketometer, or serum, of course. And you should find basically nothing in the urine at this point, but you'll find that the ketones start to then, you've now established a metabolic flexibility, quote unquote, and you're now going to see the ketone levels drop. And it doesn't mean that they're moving out of ketosis. It means their body's being much more specific, much more precise. It knows how much to make, because it basically had to remember, right? When you get into ketosis, had to remember, oh, we have this function. We actually can fat burn and make ketones, et cetera, et cetera. So the acetoacetate and the BHB. And the only thing you're really going to measure is the BHB. And I like the finger pricks best. I know there's a lot of breathalyzers out there that's based on acetone, and acetoacetate is really kind of a hard thing to measure. So it's beta hydroxy. Butyrate is the ketone that you'll be measuring, that I kind of say is the gold standard, but you can choose. So you have to counsel on that. And so the numbers are going to go down. It's not a crisis. You're telling that they're becoming more metabolically flexible. The body's learning how to produce so much and to use so much, so that between production and consumption is becoming a narrower and narrower gap, because it's becoming very precise. That's a good thing. So that's the other thing. So you're going to see a decline, and that's been documented in a number of studies. And therefore, when you know, in the last 10 years, really there's no studies on the ketogenic diet outside of epilepsy before the last 10 years. And so this idea of nutritional ketosis it's a made-up term. It's now become the currency that people use. What is nutritional ketosis? And it came out of Volek and Finney, who wrote a couple of books together and so on. So they So they came up with that term, and that's it. So nutritional ketosis, and they see it as becoming down to anything above 0.6. So when you first start getting into ketosis with any of your patients, they're excited because they're seeing twos and threes and fours and fives. And should they learn about MCT oil, they can pop it up into seven. Not necessarily that's good, but there is a way to artificially keep it up higher through MCT oil. And by the way, that's right out of the 60s. 1960s, they, I think it's 1970, maybe it's 1971. A number of studies that they were saying, can they use medium chain triglycerides to make the ketogenic diet a little more flexible? You know, so kids weren't always having to measure their things and being the weird kids in the back of the cafeteria. It was too much pressure for them. So that's where that was. So it's an old idea. It's now come forward. I'm sure any MCT oil will do well. It doesn't have to be CA, caprylic acid triglyceride. Though that is the most effective, and that's how you make ketones. Also, then that begs the question about exogenous ketones. I would keep the exogenous ketones out of the conversation because, especially with a diabetic, you know, you don't want them to be, you want them to be working for it. So you're already worried about ketoacidosis. They're just going to have to work slowly by dietary changes. So there's that. That's the first thing there. So in the urine, you see those things, and in the liver panel, and basically the kidney panel, as I call it, is important. And I think you do need to do some before testing. I mean, I do a whole panel, and I'm just looking here at what I call an assessment that I've put together, which is the common and I think slightly uncommon. But I think you better do the insulin, choose to do the glucagon or not. It's just going to give you a degree of pathology if it's out of whack. There was one woman who was low. I mean, also it speaks to hypoglycemia as well. That's why people are coming into you. And they will find it harder to initiate if they're a hypoglycemic, which means they can't get their blood sugar up. You really need to handhold them, but the same labs is what you would look for. But I had one woman come in and she was very low. I mean, pretty much non-existent. And usually when you see the pathology of, you know, high insulin that then kind of bleeds over and it starts, you know, wailing away on the alpha cells on the pancreas, and then the alpha cells start producing when they're not supposed to produce, which is the glucagon, and then to the liver, gluconeogenesis, and then to the glucose going up. She had always kind of a deep depression. You know, I mean, when we would do these weekly reviews for 12 weeks, and if she felt she failed, I just sort of would discuss about her diet, she would take it so personally. And a couple times she just cried. So it's like you couldn't even have kind of an objective conversation with her because she was so emotionally frail. How do I tie that with low glucagon? Low glucagon, when you have chronic low blood sugar, but her blood sugars were actually normal, 85. So whether she had hypoglycemic events, you know, between our meetings or between her measurements of her ketometer, I don't know. But she was very emotionally frail, very low glucagon, and I never got to do her genomic panel, and that would have been really interesting. So FYI, look at these things. Elevated glucagon. I told you what that means. What other panels would I look for? I mean, that's the heart of the dangerous things to look for. Other than that, so you asked about, the question was about albumin and protein. Well, albumin and protein go, well, I know I can take a look. Albumin and protein stay the same for the most part, might go down a little bit, but as you know, I mean, that has a lot to do with, you know, you really have to document what are they actually doing. Because keto is this word people toss around. I did keto for a while, it didn't work. Okay, what'd you actually do? You know, we have this free Facebook group. Don't do that, by the way, because you get all these questions. And when people ask that, and you go, well, what'd you do? They stop asking. They just like disappear. So you got to know. I mean, if they're actually a patient or a client, you got to know what they're actually doing. And so I require anybody that works with me, they got to you know, live with Chronometer. I'm sure you could do another app as well. It's free. Tell them it's free, and they got to learn how to use it. But once they get up and running, it's a piece of cake, and it's very helpful. So you got to see what they're eating and to make sure, are they really doing quote-unquote keto, or are they just making it up and slapping on the fat? Are they just a high-fat diet, period? Have they dropped the carbs? Do they consistently drop the carbs, or do they apologize to you on a regular basis? Oh, that was a bad day, or this is a bad day. So there's that commitment thing. So we're assuming that everybody's committed to 20 or under, and they care about it, and they're driven enough to pay attention to that. So if that's our assumption, then we obviously will see things like glucose will change, of course. Insulin will change, of course. And just on the level of going keto, you know, well, how much fat? Basically, we measure their you know, their basal metabolic rate. So you get their caloric estimate for the day. And so they have basically a high amount of fat. And that this is kind of like the starting point for keto. You can do a low carb and a non-high fat keto, but I think you need to transition to that. I do think there's an advantage of starting with a high fat form of keto. Call it smothering, but it sort of makes it so they get into metabolic flexibility. Then you can start dropping down the fat as a percentage, and you can even, you know, push towards whether it's a carnivore in that direction. I'm not a big carnivore per se in that formal sense of the word, though it's kind of a vague reference. I'm more about protein sparing modified fast, whereas you do start to drop. When you drop your fat, you will drop your fat in your diet. When you drop your fat in your diet, you'll drop your fat in your body. And I think that's the most efficient form. But you have to pass through the door of a ketogenic diet and then drop the fat down as you migrate in that direction. You don't have to go that far. That's simply where I go, and I think is a good, healthy place to be. But so there's the fat part. They don't have to smother themselves in perpetuity under all that fat. They can start dropping it down because most people come into keto, apart from the epileptic group, and they probably won't be working with you, they are about losing weight for the most part. Okay, thyroid, are there any sort of thyroid connections? It is reported, but I have not seen in my data so much, that you get a subclinical hypothyroidism, and that is based on TSH primarily, of course, and the number will go up, of course, to be a subclinical. But I've only had a few that came close in that direction. And so that would be the other thing to look at to follow thyroid. It may or may not be an issue. The other thing that in the change of dropping the carbs, and again, if you know where the person's starting from, especially women, that hair loss is a big deal. I don't know, you know, it was 8 or 9 years ago we started, so I can't remember if I lost any hair or not. I've always been a rather thin-haired person, so I don't even remember it. Obviously, it wasn't an event for me. My wife says she did lose hair, and then I don't know how long it took to come back, but I would say give it 6 months, maybe even a year, but women will, 20% or more will report hair loss, and they may freak out about that. So what is that about? I do believe your cortisol will go up, hence contribute to the sugar level. But I think the transition is in an adrenal shock to the system. And that shock to the system is what, you know, boom, does feed into the hair loss. And I think that's the cause. And so since there's adrenal aspect of that transition of dropping the carbs, because when you drop the carbs, it really is about fasting, right? You are fasting. Well, you're having carbs, but you've really dropped it a lot. Hence, when they talk about a protein-sparing modified fast, you're in essence carbless. That's not included in the meat you're eating, which is basically nil, can be a shock. So working towards dropping down the carbs is a word to the wise. And that depends on the person. So where are they starting from and what's their personality like? So that is an issue. Does it tie in with hypothyroidism? Does it tie in with, I haven't actually measured adrenal glands. You know, it's that's a little bit too large of a panel that people that work with me have to pay out of pocket. This is about a $500 panel that I'm looking at now, so I try to keep it down. What else? I would look at electrolytes, and so, but the thing is, electrolytes, people talk about electrolytes, and they talk about keto rash sometimes, and the keto headache, and so on, and that it's relieved by electrolytes. Sodium is the primarily, and none of these ever show up in serum. So as much as you can talk about electrolytes, you'll never see a low potassium, a sodium, or calcium, or magnesium. But yet, they do improve with, at the top of the list, they would probably improve with sodium. So just get them to have a good source of salt, unless they're salt sensitive. But so the majority are not, so that's good. After that, it might even be the potassium. And then, of course, magnesium. I mean, so you're, and then you obviously get can supplements that have all three. But I would say, for the most part, 80% is solved of those people who have those problems with the sodium. So it can be sea salt or something. After that, I would consider adding the potassium or get a combo. And then, and that would be a, you might be hearing about muscle cramps. And so that's more about potassium, even though, again, not once have I ever seen this show up in serum. And I'm trying to think in terms of intracellular. So we use SpectraCell. Have I seen potassium show up as a, you know, they're, it's almost unreportable. I mean, it's, I've never seen it externalized in a lab value, but I would consider that. That would be one of the other things that you will have reported, muscle cramps, maybe at night, maybe during the day, and you can differentiate between the magnesium and the potassium kind of thing. So there you go. But mostly it's a sodium. And then, of course, you can always add magnesium because we all like magnesium. What else would you see? I would look at, in terms of your CBC now, I would, of that shock aspect, you know, see if any of the basic CBC parameters change. What parameters would I think might change? Not many, but since it's such a cheap test to do, where am I? Scroll down to CBCs. See if there is a, you know, if they were not big in a protein initially, and they're now still probably not very big on protein, they may be iron poor, borderline iron poor, especially if female, and now you're adding another stress to that. I would watch, you know, the MCH, mean corpuscular hemoglobin, MCV, mean corpuscular volume, and from there you would assess, is there a folate or B12 problem there, just as eyeball, and then follow it up specifically with serum B12, methylmalonic acid, and RBC, red blood cell folate. And there, you know, and even then I've gotten some positives, but I support that with what I find in the intracellular with SpectraCell. Intracellular lymphocyte. So, but I always do the ratio of neutrophil to lymphocytes and see where they started from and see where the changes are, because you'll probably, I think that's what I was after, you'll probably see the stress accentuated there. They're having, it's like a mini sort of upregulation of your white blood cells in its various components, primarily neutrophils and lymphocytes, to get over the shock. And I think that's primarily where I would leave it. So, you know, they're not having more protein, so it's not like you're going to see your BUN go up, even though you watch those things. You're not going to see, your responsibility is around the kidneys. And so those tests obviously are part of what you need to look into. But I don't see that they're going to change unless that person starts to really increase their protein and they're on kind of a higher protein ketogenic diet, because that's what they want to be or something. And a higher protein ketogenic diet is really a protein sparing modified fast when they don't do carbs at all. But they should not just start on that, because I think that would be too much. If they've never done anything like this before, it would be too much of a shock to their system. And not that they're going to suffer terribly, it's just that it's just too problematic and it's too much hand-holding for those individuals. So I'll leave it at that and hope that, the fish oil is a little bit esoteric. Carnitine is interesting to see where people start. You can tell who's a meat eater, who's not. Obviously the vitamin D and not. But I don't see much change in the albumin or protein if they haven't changed that component of their diet. They're probably going to be low protein when they started it and continue low protein. So they may be, borderline low to start with and continue borderline low unless they increase that particular component. So I hope that was helpful. A bit too technical, but maybe not for the others that are listening in. But that's what you go. And I strongly believe in labs. I love looking at labs because there's a story here. And most people are ignorant about their own health until they have time to think about it, which is usually in their 60s or 70s. And I'm not saying it's too late then. It's just that they wasted a lot of their own life by not being at least a little more aware. Wasted a lot of time, I should say. I did forget one test. And it's not part of the regular. It's starting to become part of the regular, which is the homocysteine. And I think homocysteine and the CRP, of course, go together with inflammation, but and diet, so there's a lot of ways you can have elevated homocysteine, but my ears go up, my eyes, dilate when I see that, because I then think, I wonder what their genomic predisposition is. What are some of the mutations around the folic acid cycle and their methionine cycle as starters? And what is their history around addiction and so on and so forth? So it opens up a whole nother door. But in terms of basic labs, it is on the panel as I'm just sort of scanning it now. And some people are clearly high. It does work out that it has those associations. Others are high because they have a lousy diet. And most people are coming to you because they have a lousy diet. But they have a lot of animal products, a lot of dairy in particular, has been my experience, even though you don't see that documented, to equate to elevated homocysteine without it being a real genomic associated case. You know what I mean? So there wasn't a lot of polymorphisms. There certainly wasn't the MTHFR. There were other ones about, methionine reductase or some of these others, or maybe, PEMT and so on, without getting into that. So homocysteine would be the other one I would look at and saying a before and after. I would think that before and after of these elevated homocysteines, you'd probably see that come down because they're a little more focused on their diet. More than likely they will, people love dairy and people come into keto thinking it's a dairy deal. And if they're a dairy deal keto person, which there is not the way I do nor advocate to do keto, they will continue to have these problems for the most part. FYI and homocysteine, it's a great test to do, and it can open up some other doors and certainly refer back to their diet. All right, till next time.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp again for a brief reminder of something I completely forget to do at the end of every episode. You've heard me talk long enough in many different episodes, but what I would love you to do, and many of you have already done this, I just want to reinforce this particular behavior, which is to send me your questions. Send me questions on anything you have about keto. If there's something that I don't know, I will look it up. And if it's something that intrigues me, I will probably make an episode, a podcast about that particular topic. So what you need to do is to send me your questions at drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. So that's drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com, drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Feel free to join our Facebook group, which is also ketonaturopath.com. That's been growing lately. You also have to answer a questionnaire should you choose to join. And I don't ask for your email. I ask that you follow our terms. I try to avoid advertising and the obvious interruptions of just a good Facebook group. So hope to see you at one place or other. Please send me your questions. And look forward to talking to you and getting to know you. Take care.